thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Band Biographies. You can find more episodes at bandbiographies.com. That's B-A-N-N-E-D biographies.com. If you enjoy it, why not leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts? Apparently, it helps get the show up the charts so more people can see it, to download it, and then to leave further 5-star reviews. Another way you can help is by telling as many friends as possible to give it a download. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, on Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. But most of all, enjoy. Hello, and welcome to this very special interview with Pete Trainer, a designer, product innovator, author, strategist, applied data specialist, technologist, suicide prevention campaigner, and massive music fan. He talks all over the world on creative and social technologies, data, AI, and the physiological and psychological effects on their audiences. However, in 2023, he zigged when many would zag, and published his second book, Calling All the Dreamers, the remarkable true story about a Britpop band called Electricy, who went crashing through the music industry, but were ultimately halted by technology and shifting human behaviour. Pete got in contact with me a few months ago about the book and wondered if I'd like to read it with a view to arranging an interview with Electricy. That will still happen in future, but what struck me about the book was the level of fandom he has for this little-known band from his hometown of Yeovil, and why he felt he needed to tell the story in the first place. For many of us, I felt that this would be the perfect entry level to the Electricy story, and will certainly inform the direction of the interview with the band later in the year, hopefully. In this conversation, we not only talk about the book and the career of Electricy, we also get into what drives fandom, life in provincial towns, the pros and cons of technology in life, let alone the music industry, and Pete's role as a technologist and professional speaker, which goes deep. One additional thing before we get into the interview. The day this episode goes out, Friday the 1st of December 2023, Pete's book Calling All the Dreamers has been released in paperback form, and Electricy's debut album Beautiful Insane has been re-released because, up until now, it hasn't been available for reasons that will become obvious in our conversation. However, this new version has been produced using AI technology from the original studio demos from 1998. So be sure to visit electricy.co.uk or electricy.shop, where you can buy it, their other music, merch, and Pete's book Calling All the Dreamers. Alternatively, for the book, you could also visit Pete's website, trainer.fyi. But without further ado, here's my interview with Pete Trainer. Pete Trainer, thank you so much for coming on to Band Biographies.
Thanks for having me.
It's lovely to have you on. And thank you for reaching out and letting me know about your book, which is Calling All the Dreamers, The Story of Electricy, which is a band that I'd never heard of.
Not many people have.
No, and it's quite interesting because they had a top 20 single over here in the UK towards the end of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. So we're going to get into that in a little bit, but obviously we're going to start with just by saying that I'm sorry that it took me so long to get around to reading it. I've had a bit of a busy summer.
Don't say sorry. I'm just really happy that people are kind of consuming our project. I think it's really exciting.
Mm. And it's been out for a few months now, right? It's so much so that it's going into paperback form now.
Yeah. We've it did really well. We launched it round about the same time as their new album, actually, the band's new album, in August, and it's done really well. We've made a few little tweaks and changes, and then there's a paperback coming out with possibly a few more stories, a few other Easter eggs that we've been working on as well, so that's really exciting. But the reception's been great. We did it with the expectation that even if one person read it, we'd be happy. So there was like no expectation. And like hundreds of people have been contacting us and going like, oh, I remember those guys. Like, and we came from a town like yours and, you know, oh, where did they go? And then they read the book and they go, well, they didn't actually break up. They went off to America and did like really crazy things. So, to be able to tell their story with them has just been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that that I've said to you in text messages before getting on the call with you today is that you paint a really vivid picture of kind of semi-rural Yeovil growing up. And to be honest, I mean, it sounds a lot like Maidstone, where I grew up, although we had London less than an hour away by the train. What was the local music and art scene like in Yeovil when you were growing up?
Well, I mean, that's the relationship with Electricity, really. So in the 90s, Yeovil had a modest music scene, I think it's fair to say. We've had a few artists that have emerged. PJ Harvey came through, you know, Yeovil College and obviously went on to do amazing things. And we talk about that in the book. And there was a band called Elliot Green. And then in the surrounding towns, we had, you know, bands like Reef and Muse from Exeter, you know, were a bit later on. But it had a decent scene. But in Yeovil itself, we didn't have a huge amount. We had, it's a pretty working class town in the 80s and 90s, still is. It was a pretty, I don't want to use the word desolate because that's unfair, because we had a buoyant time. Like the 90s was a good time. We had a good pub scene, but what we didn't have, especially as young men, was kind of role model musicians. During Britpop, we saw all the kind of provincial towns and cities outside of London launching their big band. So like, you know, Manchester, you know, Bristol had Massive Attack. Like there were all these bands emerging, you know, Oasis and Blur and Pulp, and it was so good. The music scene was so good, but Yeovil just didn't have a band until this bunch of like crazy renegades shot into the pubs, clubs, and, you know, various basement bars and things that we used to frequent. And they were just like, whoa, hang on a minute. These guys are really good. Like they're not just a little bit good. They're original and they're really good. And they were really the catalyst, I think, to a bit of a change in the Yeovil music scene and just a huge inspiration to young boys that otherwise may have, you know, fallen into drugs, gone to prison and all those things that kind of happen sometimes in these small provincial towns. So they were the first, for me anyway, they were the first like huge act to emerge out of Yeovil. Certainly the first band that we admired that got a big record deal and ended up on TV. Like that was nuts.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, you paint a really, really vivid picture of it. And it seems to be almost like in places quite bittersweet, you know, looking back, there's a few people who didn't make it, a few people who went to jail, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think that's the same for a lot of places outside of, you know, your major kind of urban areas. There's not a lot to do but get into trouble.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But yeah, there were a few bands in there that I didn't realize were from down that way. I didn't realize Polly Harvey was from down that way. I don't think I realized that Reef were from the West Country, you know.
Glastonbury.
Yeah. So, I mean, and obviously Electricity, the band that the book's about, I mean, it seems like there was a lot of hometown or county pride for these bands. And was that something that was felt on a large scale, or was the music scene, especially in Yeovil, I mean, was that how many of you were in that kind of scene?
Huge. So because it's a small town, so we're talking, you know, in the 90s, 60,000, a fairly congregated nightlife is probably a fair thing to say. Like the other thing that used to happen, you know, there were raves in fields and, you know, farms and things like that. And, you know, little festivals and local bands and cover bands. Like we weren't short of cover bands, that's for sure. But we had it was a very intense sort of small scene. So one band or artist that, you know, when they stand out, like they really stand out.
Yeah.
And very, very rare. Like we didn't have a huge amount of that going on at all. But it was, Yeovil was good. Like it had a good scene. Unless you were out, you know, anyone from outside of Yeovil just wouldn't have even known it was there.
Sure, sure. I guess what struck me was the level of, I don't want to say adoration because that sounds a little bit You know, but like the hometown pride, I suppose. I mean,
yeah,
for me, I suppose because where I grew up was so close to London, I felt a little bit more connected to the London scene, and therefore kind of by association, the rest of the country, really, or what was yeah. happening, you know. And it turns out I looked through to see, you know, bands that have come out of Maidstone. There are none.
Okay.
It's cranked out a lot of it's cranked out a lot of successful sports players and actors, but not much in the way of musicians. You've got a guy who played in Soft Machine. Canterbury was the place for okay. like in the 70s, especially. But even looking at Kent, you've got Anthrax, were one of the bands that I came across. I mean, obviously Dartford and Gravesend just up the road, you've got the Rolling Stones, but nothing massively contemporary. It's really strange.
Right.
And I think there is that thing of like being a little bit close to London means that people move to London to yeah. do it. And obviously that doesn't happen down where you are. So these guys were at the same kind of colleges and schools that you and your friends were at. Were yeah. they the same age as you as well?
No, they're slightly older than us.
Right.
By not like a significant amount, like 5 or 6 years or something, but it meant when they burst onto the scene, we were just starting our kind of going out, and they'd actually, yeah. and actually Ali and Steve had been in bands together since they were at school. Nigel, Jim and Paul, who are actually from Haverford West in Wales. So they were from outside of Somerset. I think what they did for a number of years before they kind of burst onto the scene in the Southwest and Yeovil especially was, you know, craft a pretty substantial catalogue of original songs. Now that was really unusual in a town like Yeovil. We were used to bands coming on, you know, the stage at Gardens, the nightclub or whatever, or down the old barn or the butchers and performing maybe a couple of original songs and then a whole bunch of covers and sort of emulating other bands. Like that was the big deal down there. And there were some great bands doing that. We'd never seen a band be able to come on stage, look very original, sound incredibly original, like ludicrously original, and then have an hour's worth of material that was entirely theirs. That was like, whoa, this is new. Like, and it's really good as well. Not just kind of imitating other bands from that era. It was pretty good. They call themselves Britpop. I question that completely. Like I've had that conversation with them now and gone like, I think you were Britpop plus. Like, I don't think yeah, it's all Britpop.
They kind of crib from a lot of genres, and you point that out in the book quite explicitly. Like their influences came from not just other Britpop acts, but it was hip hop, older psychedelic rock. Like there's a whole load of stuff in the melting pot, isn't there? So how would you describe their sound? I mean, you say Britpop plus, like
confused. it's a really difficult one to pin down. And even, you know, just last weekend I was with them and they played some gigs in Wales and I was listening to some of their old stuff and going like, I think I love it because you can't pin it onto one genre. It's got an indie rock line that runs through everything. I mean, even the first time I saw them, the second time I saw them, they brought along a guy called Glenn Nichols, who was like a DJ scratcher.
Yeah.
So he was scratching records over the top of tracks like Lost in Space. And that was like, okay, well, Lost in Space is an indie song, if you like a kind of sort of pop rock indie track. And then you suddenly just thrown in this guy doing kind of Beastie Boy type loops over the top of your music. Like this, you're either really stupid or really brilliant. And I think, you know, it just about got away with brilliant, but it wasn't, you can't pin it down to one genre.
Yeah. I mean, the turntablists didn't really get popular for another few years with the new metal kind of explosion that happened a few years later, were they? So they were kind of ahead of the game in that respect. And unfortunately, like a lot of the bands, like a lot of bands or just artists in general that are ahead of the game, they suffer for that a little bit, don't they? I mean,
they do. Yeovil had three really successful DJs that went off and did, you know, so there was a guy called Pablo Clements that was on the scene with that bunch of guys as well. And he went off with the Beastie Boys and then went on to co-found Uncle. Like, so, you know, so there were those kind of artists like kicking around town. who were working with the, you know, the various musicians, and there was one studio, Small World Studios, and they, so there was a scene down there, but then merging them together was not something that tended to happen in these small towns. And I think Electricity were one of the first to go, well, let's cross the streams and hope that the world doesn't blow up.
And I suppose, how many times did you see them live, do you think, in that kind of, because they were quite they burnt bright and fast, didn't they?
So that is the question. So I was trying to work this out. In fact, I did work it out with them, because during the process we went back and looked at set lists from gigs throughout 96, 97, and then in 98. And I think I probably saw them 200 times.
Wow.
Literally. So in 98, so 96, they kind of started getting into the scene in Yeovil and the surrounding towns. We'd follow them around everywhere, go see what they were up to. 97, they didn't gig quite so prolifically because they were basically writing the music, the album and things. Then in 98, when the album and everything came out, they were actually christened the hardest working band in the UK by the Guinness Book of Records or something ridiculous, because I think they did 198 gigs in like 250 days.
Yeah.
It was stupid. And we got in our funny little cars and followed them around to most of those gigs, or as many as we could manage. So we saw them a lot, and it was, yeah, like I think we were fans. I think that's what fans do, right? So
it's safe to say the least you could be called is a fan, I think.
Yeah.
What do you think it is about the band that inspired such rabid fandom?
Well, in lots of us as well. Do you know what? I think it was genuinely because we saw a little bit of us in them.
Hmm.
And, you know, we were never mocked for it either. I had friends at school that, you know, whose parents drove them to every Take That concert in right. England,
yeah.
You know, and I think I think you just see a bit of yourself in something, or you hear something that makes you go like, oh, right, okay, I get that. And I know people in the town when we were growing up that really didn't like their music.
Hmm.
It just wasn't for them. But then I knew people that were kind of like, oh, right, you're singing our songs. These are for us.
Hmm.
My first big love was Pearl Jam. And, you know, the first album I bought was, you know, 10.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had friends that thought that it stunk and just didn't get why I was obsessed with that kind of music. And then, so I just think they clicked in with me. And then I think there was a bunch of us that were looking for an escape route out of a sort of beige town, and they looked like a good escape route. Mm. Like it wasn't just the music. It was the adventure that they were going to go on, that we were going to go on with them, that I think was incredibly inspiring. And I wanted the book to kind of, I guess, allude to that as well, and just make sure that people knew that they rescued a lot of us from ourselves.
Yeah, because like you said in the book, there wasn't a lot of opportunity at the time. There's a military technology company or a manufacturer in the town, and, you know, general kind of factory jobs, which I think was basically it, wasn't it? I remember going to careers advice at my school. So I think I'm only a couple of years younger than you.
Okay.
So there's an analog between what you were experiencing and what I was experiencing, I think, because every single time you name an album in there, you're like, oh, this is what me and my friends were listening to. I'm like, yes, I was doing the same thing, like exactly the same albums. But yeah,
I think the other thing you've just described there as well, which is really important for me when I was writing this, is it's not just a, I think it was like a love letter to music.
Mm, yeah, that's, and what I got, I think, very much so, especially in the early chapters where you're setting the scene, you know.
But I think all of us who are music lovers or somehow inspired by tunes were taken on journeys by these artists. We happened to have our own, and that was kind of what it was.
Mm.
So that's where that pride thing comes from. But I think music can be just wonderful escapism from kind of fairly mundane lives.
Mm. Mm. And as you say, having seen them over 200 times, I mean, you're kind of perfectly placed to write a book about them. I mean, tell us a little bit about how the genesis of this book came about. Was this a lockdown project? Has it been bubbling under the surface for a long time? Has it been gnawing at you for this many years? about, you know, what happened to the band after they went to America.
Definitely. So this was definitely an itch that I was trying to scratch for a long time. And I think it's really important as well that people don't go, it's a weird book to write about a band that a lot of people forgot about quite quickly. So I've had a few people go like, of all the bands you could have written a book about, like, why that one? And it's just a really incredible story that people never got to hear. And that was part of the itch that I didn't scratch. But the real genesis of it was that they launched, so they released this album, Beautiful Insane, in 98. It was not the album that we were expecting to get. So they did the tour of the town, you know, they played these amazing songs. We'd heard them hundreds of times. Then they go off into the studio with producer Robin Miller, you know, that Universal had helped them find. They create this album, and I remember playing it for the first time. In fact, I've still got the tape that I bought from Acorn Records, right? Play it in my car. Doesn't sound any, it's way overproduced. Like, it's a crazy concept album. And that kind of seeped in, that had been there since 98. Like, why did they do that? Like, why did they take their songs? It's still a brilliant album. It's still, for me, like, seminal in the 98 year. It's a great, great, great album, but it's just massively overproduced. That was the genesis of it right there. So I'd always wondered, like, what the hell happened to that album? Like, how did that thing emerge from those things? They go off to America in 2000. They released a second with Arista. When they got signed to Arista, dropped by Universal, signed by Arista, they do a second album in America called In Here We Fall. Had some banger hits on it. Like, it had some absolute bangers. Did really, really well in America. They never got their props for being one of the only bands to go to America and kind of crack it for a while. Had a top 20 in Japan, like, they, you know, with Cosmic Castaway, I think it was, all Renegades. So they just did all this amazing stuff, and then they just vanished. Bang, just gone. I was working in technology at the time in London. I'd come up to London by then and was working in technology, and they just disappeared. Like, the internet led us to a certain place with them. We could follow what was going on forums and things, and then they just stopped. That was kind of 2003, 2004. Had nothing from them. Now, this is where it got interesting for me, and this is where this kind of obsession started. In 2008, my career took me to that passion for music that I had took me to form, like, co-found a music startup called Mflow. It was a music platform. It's one of the first sort of legal streaming platforms after Napster and LimeWire and stuff. And part of the deal was we would get these huge, we'd sign these huge record deals with the majors, and they would send us hard drives of all the music to digitize and load onto the platform. First thing I did was go looking for Beautiful Insane. That was literally the first thing I did. I was like, right, find me the album by Electricity. I've got to play it to you all in the office. Wasn't there. We had every other song from Universal, every album from Universal and all the other majors. Like, Beautiful Insane did not exist. So in 2008, that's really where this itch really got itchy, because the band had vanished, then their album had vanished. There was seemingly no reason for it. And I've always been trying to find out what the hell happened there. Then last year, I reconnected with Steve, the guitar player from the band. We swapped some messages over Twitter. Like, he found out that, you know, I was big in the technology scene and had questions about some of the AI stuff I was doing. I was started talking to him about how big a fan I was of the band. We just got talking, and then they told me what the story behind everything that went on was. And I was like, I can now scratch this itch.
and it's a mad story, isn't it?
It's a mad story. And it's, you know, I just thought that maybe, I don't know what I thought, but I thought it was, I didn't think it was going to be this. And yeah, it's just, it's been a blast.
Yeah, I can imagine it is. I mean, having been to so many gigs, I mean, were you at all friendly with the band, you know, while they were touring the UK before they moved to America? Were you on talking terms with them while they were in the pubs and clubs?
Friendly is a strong word. I don't think so, because we were younger, and they they had a really good connection with the fans, and they did have a big fan base, by the way. They did have a, by 98, they did have a big fan base, and they would always acknowledge the kids, the teenagers, the fans that traveled around. So they were regulars. So they knew us and various people that had been on that journey with them. When I met them last year, they had no idea who I was. So they, you know, they didn't go, oh, you're the kid from 98. Like nobody had any idea. But, you know, obviously I think, once we started to unpack some of these things and, oh, you know, so-and-so and I know so-and-so and then we're from a small town, everybody knows everybody who knows everybody. And then I say, look, these are all the gigs that we went to. And they were like, wow, that's incredible. But I also think, you know, we have to remember that these were young men in a whirlwind of the music industry, which again is also kind of covered in the book. And I'm not saying that they, I think they were in such a, by 98, it was, everything was so frenetic and they were touring so aggressively and the label and the trappings of the music industry and fame and all that kind of stuff were going on around them that, you know, we were just furniture in the background. And I'm cool with that. Like, it doesn't bother me at all. But those are things that we've been unpacking over the last year as well. Quite philosophical things about fans and bands. And it's great.
Yeah, no, it must be such a strange full circle moment. To get back round to telling the story. I mean, was it easy getting all of the members to speak about their roles in the band? Because there was, you know, there were members who were fired and replaced, you know, and also them being scattered across the globe now as well.
Yeah.
You know, were any of them more or less forthcoming than others? Was it like pulling teeth with some?
No, actually, to be fair, I picked the right time to launch into this. So there were fractures, there were issues, there were things that happened during their time together. We could talk about some of that stuff, but just a couple of years ago, they actually all got back together to record this new album. So that was a kind of a lockdown thing that they did that I was not even, you know, on the scene with them for. They sort of built some bridges, worked out technically how to record an album across four different continents, you know, made amends, got a lot of the skeletons out of the closet and stuff, started creating this incredible album, which came out this year. So they were already kind of all on speaking terms. And that was one of the reasons that they thought, well, actually, when I said to them, I've written a book before, like I know the process of literature, I know how to do this, I think I could tell your story and we could get that out at the same time as the album, they were all in. So getting them to talk was not the issue. The time zones is an issue. Obviously, you have to all get to know each other in a way where everybody feels comfortable and they have to know that I'm not some kind of exploitative journalist scumbag that just wants to like spew them all over the internet or anything like that. So once we got comfortable and the process was going, it was actually really easy. There's a few people that just did not want to take part at all, which again was like really part of the story in itself, because I'm like, well, hang on a minute. That guy not only didn't want to speak to me, he basically slammed the door in my face. Like, well, there's a story there.
Right.
But then what we also managed to do throughout this process, which I thought was really beautiful, is there are actually a whole bunch of people that contributed that they hadn't seen for a long time and did come out, you know, willingly. And we connected with Glenn, the old DJ that I mentioned. And there's a beautiful human being called Ronnie that was on one of their singles. We found Ronnie and Ronnie chipped in, and then John Sweet, the producer that did the original demos, whose story in the book is also really incredible, from the, you know, his garage in Yeovil where those demos were recorded. You know, they hadn't spoke to him for 20 years and he contributed, and then we got, you know, the band back together with him for the first time in, you know, 20 odd years, which was beautiful as well. So we almost ended up having too much material. That ended up being a bit of an issue.
So how did you cut it down? I mean, I assume there were probably some stories that weren't publishable and they were easy to cut, but I'm sure there were other things that were harder to cut. So how, because I'm a journalist by trade, so I know the ins and outs of having too much information and how to like try and cut your darlings a little bit. But in a book, I don't, you know, I've never tried writing a book before. So take us through a bit of the process of that. Editing-wise.
We didn't set a limit. We set a skeleton, so we knew, because this is a story that runs chronologically, it's really easy because you kind of start at a certain date and you know you have to end at a certain date. So that was really good. We pieced all that together, and that process at the start was actually very cathartic for everybody. So that was kind of, you know, putting stories on a timeline, my story, their story, you know, albums, events. That was really good. And then hypothesizing, well, actually, if I wrote and we unpacked that story and it's X amount of words, and then that one and that one and that one, that would get us to a number. And I just kind of went with it. We've got so many articles that, again, help paint the picture. So we've got, there's some of it I don't even need to write because, you know, we've got the NME articles and the Melody Maker and all the local press clippings that Steve captured. And again, they were in boxes sort of getting ready to fall apart and rot. And I was able to use some AI technology to effectively grab the text off those and clean it up and plop it into the book really quickly. Mm. We got to 125,000 words, like really rapidly. Then it was a kind of an edit and a chop. Some, like you said, some of the stories we just thought were inappropriate to publish. Some of them I did manage to squeeze in with some really good insurance. We just kind of knew when it was finished. We kind of hit a date and we kind of knew when it was done. To be honest with you, my wife will hate me for saying this, but I would quite happily see another volume come in at some point.
Wow. Electricity Part 2.
Well, because they kind of feel like they're just getting going again now, and their new music is kind of better than their old music. And I think they've probably got another 4 albums in them. I don't think the ride is going to be as wild, but I just have a feeling once they start releasing new music, different people are going to come out of the woodworks with things to say and contribute. And it's like, okay, there's more there. So I don't know. But
watch this space.
Well, yeah, I don't know. Like we've certainly got some stuff brewing. There's certainly some bits and bobs like happening right now, which I think are almost a better end to the story than writing more words. We found the album, and not just the album that was released that I talk about in the book as being not disappointing but confusing. That they talk about a lot in the book about being like, we found the demos. So, you know, they have the opportunity now to release the version of the album that it should have been and not the album version of the album that it was.
Oh, the original album, Beautiful Insane.
Yep.
Right. Interesting. Because as you were saying, when you were trying to find it all those years ago, when you set up your music startup, you couldn't find the album online. And actually, I always try and listen to the back catalogue of the bands that I'm talking about so that I can get a broad overview. And also while I was reading it, I kind of had them on quietly in the background. So I was kind of seeping the music in as I was reading about it. And I had to go onto YouTube to find a playlist that someone had put together of those songs, because it just doesn't exist anymore, does it? And there's a hypothesis that links in with the fact that Universal didn't give you or couldn't give you access to that material.
Yeah, Universal were pissed off. Like they were not happy with that album. They spent a lot of money. They went to Abbey Road to record some of it. You know, they'd got Robin Miller, this incredible producer. They didn't get the album that they were expecting. And I think it irritated them like a lot. I think they thought they were going to get like an Oasis style Britpop album that would appeal to that kind of audience. And they got this album of, you know, one of the tracks on it, Chemical Angel, sounds like a Prodigy song.
Yeah.
And not a great one either, but, you know, just it sounds like some sort of crazy sort of.
Well, it is a rave track, isn't it, basically?
Yeah.
And it's and about so, like, the same kind of subject matter as well. You know, it's in the title, isn't it?
Yeah, it was mad. And, you know, it had all these kind of references to various things on the album. So they kind of, they just, not only did they not release the album, like they just kind of stopped, they stopped making it on CD and vinyl, which is all you can get now on like eBay and things like that. When everything was being digitized, they just didn't bother digitizing it. And then there was that fire in LA where actually a lot of the Universal masters were being kept, and that was in kind of 2007 2008. There was this huge fire at a warehouse where a lot of British DAT tapes were being stored by a lot of huge artists like the Police and stuff.
I covered that in one of the documentary episodes that I did on The Damned and Susie and the Banshees.
Okay, like, right.
A bunch of those bands, and even, you know, historical blues albums or recordings and priceless things that can, and it's all gone. It can never be remixed, as you say. Nothing could ever be done like the Beatles have just done, or Electricity may do in the future with the AI, you know, improving the originals to some of those songs. And it's really, really quite sad.
Yeah, and I Universal basically stonewalled me on the book as well. They were not interested in contributing at all. They had no, nobody wanted to even acknowledge that that band even existed. Like it was like, come on, they had a top 20. Like it was a big song. They had another couple of tracks in the top 20. They sold a couple of 100,000 albums. Like it wasn't like crazy Coldplay numbers or anything like that. But you know, they weren't insignificant. They were playing TFI Friday on a Friday night on TV to 8 million people. Like people knew who they were.
Yeah.
And yet you've buried this album. And I think it's because it just doesn't exist anymore. It's literally been like destroyed. So so back to my point, but we found the demos that they recorded originally in the Yeovil Garage, which feels like if we could get those out the door, and I've listened to the album in that form, it sounds better than the Universal version. It sounds like the band that I used to listen to in those pubs in Yeovil. And I've kind of said, if you could please just get these done, like we just get these out, then that might be the next chapter of the book that I don't need to write. Like it's literally the conclusion. So yeah, exciting. I hope they do it. I hope they
so do I, because I've become a bit of a fan actually since you sent the book to me and I've started listening to their stuff. Like I say, I can't believe that I can't remember Morning Afterglow, especially because it sounds like the kind of stuff that was in the charts at the time. Clearly it was in the charts at the time. They were playing on TFI Friday. They were at Radio 1, Western Supermare, weren't they? Playing alongside all the and other Weymouth. Bands of the day and Weymouth, yeah. So yeah, quite how they passed me by, I'm not entirely sure. But, you know, making up for lost time now. And actually what's quite interesting, bearing in mind that you're in the technology space, is that Electricity's story ties in with the birth of the MP3 and the internet. And that is another major spoke in the wheel of this story. One of the stories that I did quite that I didn't realize was the first MP3 fidelity test was on Tom's Diner,
yeah.
Which I didn't realize. I thought it would be something like Comfortably Numb or one of those other kind of lush prog songs that they used to test speaker cabinets out with.
No, Tom's Diner was the one, and it was by the German company whose name I forget. It's because it covers so many different optics,
right?
And it was relatively easy to digitize, but then it's actually quite a complex song. That I didn't know either until we were looking at this, and we were looking at, so what happened was when we put this timeline of things together for the book, I then started to place on top of that timeline like significant events in the music industry for no other reason than I thought it would be kind of fun to, you know, point out some of these junctions for all bands. And when I plopped them on top of the timeline, I realized that this band we loved had broke onto the scene, got a record deal, started getting momentum almost at exactly the same time as piracy, Napster, MP3, you know, technology, blah, blah, blah. And all these different heartbeats in the technology industry kind of map to these different moments in their journey as well. So, like they were, and thousands and thousands and thousands of other bands were effectively victims of piracy.
Yeah.
Electricity had no idea, because they were in their kind of weird touring whirlwind, you know, lifestyle as bands are.
Yeah.
They had no idea. They had absolutely no idea that, you know, Universal and Arista, the two record labels, had seen their profits half in, you know, almost overnight, just as they'd tanked a load of money on one of the, you know, this band, suddenly they're in financial crisis. They didn't realize that, you know, when they were in America and their first American album had done really well, that Arista were, you know, trying to work out what the heck to do and where to cut their cloth and who to drop to try and shore up cash, because, you know, Napster, LimeWire and BitTorrent were kind of eating away at their profits by some substantial amount as well. So that technology thread, I think, is kind of ironically all the way through this.
Yeah,
it's still just bigger now.
It just strikes me as interesting that, you know, this is the story of one band, but It could be the story of, like you say, any number of thousands of bands, really, that were kind of on the cusp, but not quite. They didn't quite have the juice behind them, especially in the, you know, the kind of political realm and the financial realm of these record companies that were obviously grappling with things on the business side. And all of a sudden, it makes sense to just slash the bottom line, essentially. And how many bands has this happened to? How many Electricities are out there, you know?
Oh, tens of thousands, and, you know, millions of artists that either never got a shot or were just on the ascendancy when they had to change the business model. And also, like, Electricity, just, it's why I love them, and they're great human beings outside the band as well. They never played the game. They were never like Yes Men, and they never did anything. You know, if the labels told them to zig, they'd zag. And it was like, that's not what people like Coldplay and stuff have done. They've played the game really, really well, and they've, you know, done all the right things, and they've played along nicely, and they've, you know, sold out stadiums and stuff because they've got people telling them what to do, and they go away and do it. Electricity didn't do that. They were probably top of Universal's list, and then probably Arista's list as well, when they were going, we've got to get rid of one of these bands. Like, which one? I mean, they go, that one right there, like, get rid of them.
The oddballs. <'Cause>
they're not going to play our game. So they go.
They seemed like they were intent on having fun all the time, massive amounts of fun.
They indulged in all of the best parts of being rock bands,
which is what you want from your rock stars, right?
100%. I mean, you can't begrudge them that. I begrudge them getting dropped twice because I wanted to follow them around, you know, for the rest of my life. But they definitely had a good time.
And I mean, you managed to follow them to Dublin once as well, which was an interesting story. Actually, one of the more edgy stories was actually involving yourself.
So I didn't follow them to Dublin. I was actually at the very last gig that was done at Lansdowne Road. It was an Oasis gig. It was on the Standing on the Shoulders tour.
It was an Oasis gig.
You know what? No, but it is an Electricity thing. So this is the kind of other thing about Electricity, is they, even when it's not Electricity, it's still Electricity. They've just kind of like bugged us our whole lives. We went to see Oasis at Lansdowne Road in Dublin, and we had an absolute belter of a time. I think it was 2000. And after the gig, a load of, you know, the Irish had said, well, one thing during the gig I had noticed, which was that I distinctly remember watching Oasis at the time and thinking, we've got a band that's better than this, genuinely. So that's that hometown pride thing again. I remember thinking Ali McKinnell was a much better front man than Liam Gallagher, whatever. Love you, Liam, if you're listening. but then these Irish guys say to us, oh, everyone's going down to this place called Leeson Street. And it's Lower Leeson Street. It's down in Dublin, just off Temple Bar. So we follow them down there, and it's basically the red light district of Dublin at the time, if they had one. It's just kind of strip clubs and seedy night bars and stuff like that. And my best friend Neil says to me, let's go in that one over there. There's a bar over there called Angels, which happens to be one of the most popular Electricity songs. It's a beautiful track called Angels.
Yeah.
So we just like, oh, let's just go in there, because that's kind of the first signal of Electricity pointing us in a direction. Go into this bar, and it's really, you know, not particularly pleasant. I get talking to one of the people that's working there, shall we say, and I recognize her accent, and she happens to be from Yeovil, of all the places in the world to bump into somebody. There's a kind of basically a stripper from Yeovil in a dive bar in Dublin. And I joked with her, oh, we only came in because of the bar's called Electricity, Angel by Electricity, at which point she's like, oh, I'm a big fan of Electricity. And we probably sat at the bar for an hour and just talked about the back catalogue, and, you know, and here we fall, Beautiful Insane. That was my trip to Dublin. It still got cannibalized by Electricity. It's great.
It's brilliant. It's that and the story of Ali meeting the head of Arista Records as well.
Clive Davis.
Yeah, one of the absolute standout anecdotes from the band.
Yeah, the Clive Davis story is a wonderful, wonderful thing. Do you want me to tell it?
Yeah, go ahead. Please do.
I've got time.
Yeah. Oh, All the time you want. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, well, so I think your listeners should probably Google Clive Davis Arista.
He's an impressive man.
He's a very impressive man, but then the story kind of makes sense. So they got binned by Universal. When he told me the story, I was crying. I was like, you've allowed me to write this down. What a privilege this has been. So the band got dropped by Universal. Steve and Nigel were still kind of the guitar player and the kind of songwriter, bass player. They were kind of down in London, sort of hawking around, trying to, you know, they've got some extra new tracks. They're looking for new management and new label or whatever. Ali's gone up to Glasgow to live with his, you know, then girlfriend at the time. And they'd, you know, just kind of in a bit of a rut. Nigel gets a phone call saying, there's a guy at the Dorchester Hotel wants to see you. Can you go tomorrow? So they go down to the Dorchester. They go up to the penthouse in the Dorchester. They're greeted by, you know, the various execs. You say, we've got somebody here that wants to meet you. And it's Clive Davis, the head of Arista. So he's the founder of Arista Records in America. He's like a big deal. You know, he's like the, you know, one of the godfathers of the sort of contemporary music industry in America. Clive's very impressed. He loves the demo. Like he thinks that they've got this, you know, great song called Renegades, which is on the second album. And I've got that demo as well, by the way. It's outstanding, the actual demo version.
Right.
But then Clive says to them, I don't, like, you guys are good, but I need to meet the guy. Like, I need to meet this charismatic front guy you've got. Like, where is he? I need him here by tomorrow because I'm flying back to America. So they panic ring Ali. They say, Ali, you got to come down to London, like, now. We've got this guy that wants to meet us, to meet you. And, you know, this could be the next shot in the arm that we needed. Ali, being the rock star or the wannabe rock star that he was, flies down on the plane, gets absolutely plastered on free booze on the plane on the way down from Glasgow, gets to the Dorchester, goes up in the lift. And actually, now that I've got to know Ali, he's a really soft soul. And I imagine he was probably masking quite a lot of nerves and anxiousness as well.
Sure.
You know, he walks into the suite. He feels like he has to put on the big rock star act, which is what he does. He gets even more drunk, like drinking out the minibar and stuff like that. Big Clive Davis walks in to meet Ali. And Ali starts calling him Mike. So Ali then proceeds to call him Mike for interrupt Clive, you know, call him Mike, give him the big one about like why Electric the best band on the planet and blah, 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 blah. The execs that are kind of kowtowing and surrounding Clive Davis are all in kind of like panic and tailspin. Who is this guy? He's coming here. He's offending our boss, blah, blah, blah. Clive Davis loves it. Anyway, it transpires, and again, this is why I say everyone needs to look at a picture. It transpires that Ali thought it was Mike Reed, who played Frank Butcher in EastEnders, because Clive Davis and Mike Reed are like doppelgangers. Like they look
it's
exactly
very, like. There's a photo in the book, and when I turned the page, I thought, well, yeah, I can see.
yeah, exactly. But even weirder, like 3 months before, they'd been on TFI Friday performing Best Friend's Girl, and Mike Reed was one of the guests on TFI Friday. So it was like in Ali's head. So Ali was drunk, walked into the penthouse at the Dorchester. He meets this guy. He's got no idea why Frank Butcher from EastEnders is like interviewing him, but he just assumes it is, calls him Mike for the entire meeting, at which point Clive Davis goes, I like this guy, I like you, he's got some something about him, and he signed them on the spot. So you've got to wonder if it had been different if Ali had turned up, been on his best behavior, and called him like,
well, that's
Sir
it,
Clive,
isn't it?
The entire meeting.
Yeah. And like you say, this guy signed everyone from Barry Manilow to Pink Floyd, Billy Joel, Bruce Springsteen, yeah. Santana. It's ridiculous. The roster that are on Arista Records that are in this book is
crazy.
Nuts.
And then by the next day, he flew him out to New York the next day to do a showcase for the execs. Like, so that was it. And that's kind of when the band disappeared and the UK stopped hearing anything about them, because Ali had got drunk, called one of the most powerful people in the music industry, Mike, not Clive, and got sent to New York, sent to the Naughty Step in New York.
I mean, it's absolutely mad. And, you know, the band changed its style a little bit and went a little bit kind of almost, they went a little bit new metal on that second
they
album.
Did, yeah.
It's definitely a more American sounding album, isn't
very,
it? And again, the release of that coincided with Davis's being replaced at Arista, And again, it was all just bad timing, wasn't it? You know,
terrible timing. They did a big tour with they'd already done a big tour in the UK with Fun Loving Criminals. They were doing a big tour in the US with like Buck Cherry and another band who I forget. So they were on the up. They'd re-released some of the UK songs on that second album. So like Morning Afterglow is on both albums, which is kind of weird. Angels on both albums. I think there were better songs on the second album than Morning Afterglow that would have been better for the American audience, like Foot Soldiers and stuff. Somebody made the decision to release the kind of slow ballad as their single in the US, which maybe wasn't the best idea. But yeah, there's some, again, there's some bangers on that second album.
Oh, definitely.
Cosmic Castaway.
Yeah.
I mean, Cosmic Castaway that's on the album is still their biggest. It's had like, I think it's 3 million streams now, Cosmic Castaway, because it was on the soundtrack to Titan AE.
Yeah.
I mean, it's huge. It's still viral on TikTok now, that song.
That's mad, isn't it? But I mean, it's from 2000 as well. It's 23 years old.
yeah. That's it. It's crazy.
And the rest of the story, it's this kind of, it's almost like a nosedive, isn't it? It's from there, it gets really not bleak, but just depressing, really, isn't it? You know, the entire music industry has changed. The rug gets pulled out from under their feet. And actually, you know, coming back to where we are now with the members, because they were living on separate continents even then, weren't they? Like one of them was living in Australia. There were people in the UK and Ali was in the US.
No, Nigel was in the US.
Was it Nigel? Was sorry. And it just feels like, in a strange way, now is the perfect time for Electricity to kind of re-energize and kind of get back into it. Because, as you said, the technology is there now. The music industry is not so all-encompassing and powerful as it was. You know, the big, you don't need to have a massive record deal to get decent streams on Spotify or Apple or whatever. Although, you know, Spotify recently changed the way that they pay out their artists, which has caused a lot of controversy for mid to low level bands. Basically means that anyone who hasn't already got a lot of juice behind them anyway is not going to get paid going forward, which I think is a terrible, terrible thing.
It's really difficult. I mean, even Electricity now are making less money on royalties with an entire back catalog, like five albums, than they're making in royalties from the book, to put it into perspective.
Wow.
Like, yeah. And there's six members of the band, right? So, you know, they don't wash their own face with what Spotify pays them off 2.5 million streams a year or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And actually it doesn't really matter. And that's from a couple of the songs. Like if people find those songs and then start listening to the rest of the back catalog, which they're starting to do, I think it's phenomenal that people were discovering their music rediscovering their music again. But financially, forget it. Like it doesn't work. The industry is still, if not more broken than it was during piracy.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? You know, the technology democratized the music making process, but unfortunately it doesn't spread the wealth anywhere near as far as it used to. I mean, even when iTunes was, you know, 99p a track, you'd make a decent amount of money off those. You know, you'd make 70p off a 99p download. And that seemed okay. And then when streaming came through, that was when the bottom fell out for anyone who wasn't already an established artist. And like, again, it comes back to that, the old chestnut of like, oh, we're not going to pay you to play, but it's great exposure. Which I hate. It's the worst thing in the world. It's like, yeah, all right, I'm on Spotify and I'm on Apple, and that means I'm on the biggest music streaming platforms in the world. But so is everyone else.
Still got to find you.
Yeah. But it's great that, you know, To the Other Side came out, and it's encouraging people to go back and discover the back catalogue. That's great.
Yes.
But yeah, for it to be a kind of touring concern again, I don't even know, because there's 360 deals now as well, where, you know, a lot of the time it was more profitable for bands to go out on tour and sell merch, but now you've got the clubs and the arenas taking a massive percentage of merch sales for nothing.
Yeah.
Like they're not even staffing these things. It's just a tax on the band. It's madness that music has been undervalued as much as it has in the last 20 years.
I think it's genuinely a concerning time for artists. You can only make music for the love of making music. And I hope that, you know, a dedicated group of people listen to it. The idea that, you know, unless you're kind of being played on Capital every day 10 times, you're going to make enough money to be able to like pay the bills. I mean, it's really quite an odd situation.
Yeah.
We're planning a tour with the band, or the band are planning a tour, which obviously I'm going to be at next year. And it's, you know, even that is really, really exciting. Get them back on in the same country, do a little tour of the Southwest, some festivals and things like that. But it's got to be done for love and fun, not profit. In fact, they'll make a loss on it by the time everyone's flown in, got accommodation and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But they still want to do it because they love making music and love touring and they're playing with each other. And I saw them at the weekend playing 3 gigs in Pembrokeshire, and they, you know, there's a chemistry there and they love playing it. But, you know, it doesn't pay anything. It's a symptom of the industry, I think.
I think everyone that I know in bands in general, I mean, I don't know many people in incredibly successful bands, but I know people in middling bands that, you know, tour a fair amount, and almost everyone's got a day job that they do on the road. And it's a hard old life, but we play music because we love it.
Yeah, exactly. Which in a weird way comes back to that original thing I said about, you know, you've got to do it for the mental health and the soul. Like, you know, we were following him around because it gave us something to do and it was kind of a happy time and stuff like that. And I guess if you strip the industry away from that, sort of a music without industry equals the same thing. They're doing it, and bands are doing it for their health and well-being and love and joy, and that's brilliant. Like, it's great, but don't expect to pay the bills with it.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. No one can be a full-time artist anymore, and that kind of brings us around again, like the technology aspects we've kind of covered a little bit on here, that you're a bit of a polymath. You're an author, you've written other books on kind of business and technology and stuff like that. You mentioned your music platform. I mean, it sounded like from the description of the music platform that you set up that it was actually going to be paying a fair amount as well. These are in the early days of this kind of thing where there was a fair payout for the artists, which is great.
Well, that was our business model. Our business model was kind of post-piracy model, where we wanted to pay the pirates and the artists. That was kind of our disruptive play. What we wanted to do was flip the people that were trading music illegally online into effectively advocates of their favorite bands, share it socially, so share the music, but then have people they were sharing it with effectively buy that music. So it was, the whole concept of the platform that we were building was like, it's like Twitter for music. So you get the stream of recommendations from these people that ordinarily would be trading illegally. If I bought a track that Tom recommended to me, I'd get 20 pence back on my account to buy more music off the stream. Right. And then the artist would make the rest, and then the label would take their bit and blah, blah, blah. And it was actually, financially, it was going to do really, really, like, for everybody, it was going to do really well. And then it was called M-Flow. The year we launched, Spotify also launched with a free model. So it was like, what? We've literally just worked out how to pay everybody for their music, and then Spotify giving it away for free.
And this is the difference between a technology company putting a music platform out and music lovers putting a music platform out. Like, there were, in the early days, companies like yourself at M-Flow that actually put a value on the on the product that you were distributing.
We were trying to rescue the industry from itself. I dare anybody listening to this to find me and tweet it to me, or X me, or whatever it's called now. You know, if you find it, like, literally send it to me. I challenge anybody to find an interview with Daniel Week where he's talking about artist, music, favorite song, favorite album, who he's a fan of. Like, I honestly challenge anybody to do that. He never talks about music.
No, because he's a businessman. He's a technology entrepreneur. It's nothing to do with, it's about, making profits for the book. I just,
It boils my blood.
If he does listen to music, I bet it's something like Enya. That's what I reckon.
Smooth jazz. Yeah. Lift music. But yeah, so like I said, I'll try and take it away from the angry side of things. So what's kind of driven you in your life and career, I suppose? Because you've had a career in tech, or you have a career in technology, but it's kind of spun out into kind of TEDx speaking.
Yeah.
And campaigning for suicide prevention and men's health and stuff like that. Like, where is that drive? How has that come about?
Everything I've ever done is human-centered or human-focused. So that's like basically my philosophy for everything. So every piece of technology I've ever designed, built, distributed has had some kind of human focus or purpose. Like, if we're going to build this thing, it might as well have a positive outcome, an impact on a group of people. You know, and I think that's always, so that at the heart of what I do has always been there. And that's why, you know, even doing the stuff we were doing with the music platform was about positive outcome. There's a lot of negativity in the world, man. And it's like, I think if people focus their talent on positive outcomes, then I think the world would be a much better place. And that's a bit of a kind of, you know, bit of a philosophical moment. Sorry about that. But I genuinely believe that. And so even though I'm a technologist by trade, and a kind of designer at heart, even my first book, which was about technology and AI and data, was called Human Focused Digital. And it is literally a philosophy of kind of, you know, amplify the very best parts of humanity, don't erode it. And so much technology does erode it. So I kind of fight against that. I've pointed technology at like you said, suicide prevention, and I've pointed it at kind of health debt. Like, I'm always pointing technology at problems that need to be solved. And then in the last year, I kind of pointed it at a couple of things, but then I end up pointing it at my favorite band, which is, but again, it was brilliant because I thought at the same time, because a lot of technology went into making this book. I mean, that is, you know, to reclaim so much stuff that was lost. There's this huge technical achievement in some of the pictures that have been upscaled using AI and blah, blah, blah.
I was going to say, so a lot of the pictures that are included in the book have been upscaled, as you say, using AI. There's a lot 100%. Of the press clippings and stuff you were saying, they've been basically saved from crumbling and turning to dust.
Every interview, so every line of copy from the band, so the book is laced with kind of my story, if you like, my narrative, and then the band chip in all the way through, that's all voice to text. So that was, you know, everything that they say is literally their words from like Zoom into text into book.
I did wonder that actually, because there are some kind of filler words that get in there. Do you know what I mean? Like, that aren't the way that you might write them if you were writing phonetic. It as a,
it's all phonetic. So it's all their voice. The, you know, and what the other thing that's wonderful about that, and again, I guess is a little bit of a kind of a lead on to what we might do next, is because I have hours and hours and hours of audio interviews with the band, the AI generating an audio book in their own words with that is super easy. Like, I can replicate all their voices, and we've already had a little play, and we found some pretty good kind of deep fake replication tools for some of their their voices, so they can narrate their own story, and I don't have to go into a studio and, you know, hire a studio to do all of that stuff. So that's great. So I think, you know, every page has got a piece of technology on it in some way. Every picture, all the bits of like torn up paper that are in the book, like every picture and every Polaroid is effectively kind of batch processed using generative AI, which ordinarily I'd be doing for a brand somewhere professionally. And I was like, let's just do it for this. Like, it'd be great. How much fun is that?
Suppose it provides you with a proof of concept as well, which is
great. Great proof of concept. we did 125,000 words. It's not perfect, but they weren't perfect as a band, and their music isn't perfect. So we kind of agreed. We just decided that if it was a bit scratchy and scrappy, that kind of fits with their mold.
Yeah.
5 months end to end for 125,000 word book. Last time I did a book of a similar size was about 12 and a half months.
Wow. So that's a real compression.
There's your case study of tech speed, you know, the pace of things.
Yeah, I mean, I use stuff like Otter AI for transcribing my interviews that I do professionally as well, and have done that for years now. And I've found from the early days of me having to go through and back and listen to the recordings and type it down as quickly as I can, like, it's so much easier.
Yeah.
And then ChatGTP has come in, and that's kind of helped a lot with being able to craft better stories, I think.
Yeah.
Like, if you know how to interrogate it properly and give it the right information to give you the best possible outcome for it. I never use it to write entire articles. I would like to get that out there in case any of my employers or clients are listening. but I do use it as a tool. I think they're brilliant tools.
Well, that came out, I mean, that ChatGPT came out as we were getting going with this. And again, like you, we didn't do any writing with it. I didn't do any of the writing with it, but it ended up being a really good fact checker and sense checker and inspirer. So even that first chapter where I'm describing Yeovil, as an author, you have to kind of, you've got the image in your head and you want to kind of put that down on paper and things like that. I knew what I wanted to say, but I didn't know how to start. So I would get ChatGPT. I would say, can you describe a, you know, dingy little town from the 1980s? And it would give me 200 words. And I'd look at it and I'd go like, okay, right. Okay. There's the click in my head.
Exactly.
And I'll use that to kind of then type my version of it. And it was great. And I'd like, there were a couple of sentences that might have crept from ChatGPT's version into my version, but by and large, it was all me. But just to get that brain matter firing and the inspiration was great.
Sometimes it can give you a different perspective that you hadn't even thought about. You know, it gives you a prompt that you're like, oh yeah, I've never even thought about it from that angle before. So
it's amazing.
I'm not in the AI is coming to take all our jobs camp. I'm in the AI is coming to help us in the large part, if you use it correctly.
Exactly. Well, I mean, here's the other one, which I forgot to mention, which really did blow my mind. And I was getting I remember ringing up Steve or messaging Steve and going like, we need to talk. Like, I think I've just cracked open Pandora's box. For years and years, I've been building these like bots that go off and look for information for some of the suicide prevention stuff and some of the ethically. So like, I don't trawl the internet looking for people, you know. It's all, everything I do has got a lens of ethics across it. So we've been, you know, I've been pretty good at trawling the internet for information using bots for years and years and years now. And like, I got this bot and I'd sent it off to bring me back whatever it could find about electricity. So, you know, fill this pot up with information, whatever you can find, just bring it back. Kind of a really clever kind of search mechanism. And it went through Wayback Machine. So if anybody's not aware of this, there's something called the Wayback Machine, which is effectively the Internet Archive. So every week, the internet backs up the internet and puts it into this archive. And this bot that we built had basically gone back over all of electricity's web pages from like 2002 back to like 98, because they were relatively, you know, early doors into the internet era. And it basically scraped like 4 years of blog posts, images, and like weird musings, and the fan forums. Because remember, we used to go and drop comments on notice boards and forums and stuff.
Yeah.
And it pulled it all back. And then that one piece of like AI that went off came back, just boom, like there's all this material. I even found comments that I left in their forum from 98, which was incredible, because it's like Pete Machine, which used to be the thing I used online. That was always me. Like, that was my handle online for everything. And I'm like searching around in this archive of stuff that this AI bot brought back. And I'm like, there's my comment from 1999. Wow. Like, how crazy is that?
That's incredible.
And just like, what? Yeah. So the technology is like, technology is great if you do it for the right things.
Yeah, I use Wayback to source some of the material that I do for the documentary episodes that I produce on here as well. I think it's an excellent resource. Pete, I don't want to keep you too much longer. I'm aware we've almost done, like, we're coming up for well over an hour and a half now. I do want to make sure that people know the name of the book. It is Calling All the Dreamers, The Untold Story of Electricity, by Pete Trainer. It's well worth seeking out, buying, reading, and then getting to know a band that had all but slipped into obscurity, but now are back with a brand new album called To The Other Side, which was released a couple of months back.
Yeah, it's awesome as well.
And there's more coming down in the pipeline in the future. I'd also like to point people towards your TEDx talks as well, because I've watched a couple of them in the last few days and they're brilliant, especially a very touching one about the guy James Dunn, who suffered from a very rare disability called EB. I can't remember the full name of it. It's got a really long...
Epidermolysis bullosa.
That's the one.
Yeah, there you go.
And yeah, that was incredibly touching and moving. When you do those TEDx talks, is that for the EB charity, or, you know?
I did that one. That was one and done. So that was
right
for James.
Okay.
Was the but Deborah is the EB charity. It's an amazing charity. Does really incredible work with a very complicated genetic disability. But yeah, again, like all those things. Thank you for mentioning those. I just like telling human stories. There's a human in the middle of every single thing, isn't there? And I think those are the people that we should be celebrating, not the technology so much. And James was an awesome guy. The guys in Electry are awesome. You're awesome. So thank you for telling my story. Yeah.
No, thank you for writing it. And thank you for getting in touch with me about the book in the first place. Otherwise, I'd never have known. So what's next for you now? I mean, obviously, you're doing a bit of work with Electricity on, you know, new projects and stuff, possibly. What's happening professionally?
I don't know, really, actually. I'm not thinking about it too much. I'm busy with work stuff. I do a lot of advisory work, helping a lot of brands with their kind of AI strategy. I try very hard to get... I'm deeply involved in quite a lot of governance and ethics stuff around AI at the moment with the government and things like that, because there's obviously a ton going on. It's a really busy time for somebody that knows even a tiny amount about AI. So it's good, but I'd like to be doing more fun stuff with Electricity, if I'm honest. My midlife crisis is like pulling me in.
Getting the band back together.
they're back together. I'm like, I'm just going to come and carry your bags. Like, how do we make this financially work for me? So,
brilliant. And finally, where can people find you if they wanted to follow you, get in touch, watch all this?
I'm on the socials. I'm on the Twitter thing. It's just at Pete Trainer. I have a website. It's trainer.fyi. But more importantly, go to electricity.online. Way more important than me, electricity.online, and there's links to the book, their albums, their socials, which, you know, I'm on anyway. They can find me via those socials. So go find the band and you'll see me lurking in the background like a weird stalker.
Brilliant. And buy the book, buy the merch, buy everything, you know.
Yeah,
spend money.
All the profits go back into the band for the tour next year, so it's worth doing it. It's like a charity book.
There you go. You'll be funding a tour if you buy the book.
Very good.
Pete, thank you so much for coming on, sharing your story, sharing the story of Electricity. And I'm going to press stop, but don't go anywhere. There you go. What a great chat that was. Pete's a lovely guy and incredibly busy, so I really appreciate and thank him for taking the time to chat with me, as well as sending me a copy of his book, which in turn opened my ears to the work of Electricity. Let me know what you think of their music on social media, or perhaps you are already fans. Either way, let me know on the socials. Be sure to check the band out on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Electricity, as well as at electricity.co.uk, or electricity.shop, where you can buy their music, merch and Pete's book Calling All the Dreamers. Alternatively, you could visit Pete's website trainer.fyi to buy any of his books, see some of his amazing work and watch his various talks. They're well worth it. All the links are in the show notes. I hope you've enjoyed this episode and do get in touch online. But until next time, take very good care of yourselves. Thank you for listening to this episode of Band Biographies. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs
Instagram at Band Biographies, search on Facebook for Band Biographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. See you next time.